Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. We're now up to episode 28, and this one's a special one. As some of you may know, this week is TechEd in Houston, and TechEd's an annual conference more focused towards IT. It's got a little bit of development built into it as well. I want to say level 100 and level 200 sessions that are held over there. And what's interesting for Azure is that there were a ton of new announcements in TechEd this year, or today. I mean, over the last couple of days. So we're going to spend this episode talking about it. Well, just let's get the introductions out of the way. My name is Sujit Mello. I am a senior consultant with Microsoft, based out of New Jersey, focused on app dev related stuff. And, I have my two favorite guys on the Skype with me.
Kale? Yeah, this is Kale Teeter. Yeah, this is Kale. I'm a MCS consultant with in the New York, New Jersey region as well, in the app dev space, and do a lot with Windows Azure, or Microsoft Azure, I'm sorry.
Hey, yeah, careful though, Kale.
Yeah,
and this is Evan Basilik, and I'm one of the leads in Windows support for Azure IaaS, and I'm down in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Excellent. Well, so guys, I don't know. I mean, it sounds like this is really a big week for Azure. I'm just looking at the long, long list of things that they released, that they made available to the public this week. Sounds like quite the release, huh?
I think the thing that amazed me about it is not just the number of things that came out, but the range of over which it spans, right? You know, different services, some of them core platforms, some of them on top of Azure, right? It's just, it's like this exponential growth that we're going through now.
Yeah. I mean, it just shows how mature Azure is becoming right now. I mean, this is all the good stuff that's, you know, just to kind of round off the edges and make it a really, really robust system.
Right. Well, yeah. The thing that, I don't know about you guys, but the thing that, is kind of scary, like you just said, right? We're you know, it's full featured and rounding off the edges. The thing's only, what, 10 months old?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, if you talk about the IaaS stuff, which almost all of this is kind of in that space. But I mean, even if you just go to broader Azure, it's 5 years. I mean, that's it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Right. It's all relatively brand new.
Yeah.
So let's get started, you know, right away. We have a lot to cover. I don't want to make it too long a podcast. First on the list that we have is the Azure Express Route General Availability. So let's get our listeners up to speed on what exactly is Express Route. Kale, you want to take that?
I'll take this one because I'm actually the lead within support for this. But so Express Route is high speed, low latency connection to Microsoft Azure, and you do it through, and there's a number of different third-party providers that we partner up with, like AT&T, we do through their MPLS situation, or we do Equinix, so it's an IPX, right, where basically, and you don't actually drag the cables, but you have a direct fiber connection to them, we have a direct fiber connection to them, and then Equinix just kind of ties the two together.
Got it.
The end result is you're not going out over the internet, and it's it literally is intranet latencies at that point.
Mm. And I guess the big announcement today, besides it being generally available, is that they've announced some new partnerships, right? I think in Europe and in APAC with the Telecity Group and Singtel. I guess they're in Singapore. And Zedera, is that how you say it?
I think so. Yeah, they're kind of an interesting fork on this partner thing because they're not a connectivity partner. But what we've actually partnered with them is you can get to they kind of have a cloud storage solution that's pretty popular.
Mm-hmm.
So now you can get basically this high-speed connectivity to their stuff.
I see. It's like a storage system that subscribers may have there.
Yeah, and so you used to have to access it through, you know, basically, you know, internet connectivity. Well, now you're accessing it with this high-speed, low-latency connectivity.
Got it. Okay, that's cool. So ExpressRoute makes it all possible now. They could access almost like a SAN, right? You're accessing it through ExpressRoute.
Yeah, conceptually, yeah.
Excellent. All right, then moving on to the next item was we have some new compute-intensive virtual machines, the A8 and the A9. I suppose these are the big kahunas. I'm trying to look up. Anyone know what the specs are on this off the top of the head? I'm trying to see what they are.
The A8 is the 8-core and the A9 16-core, and it's 56 gig and 112 gig.
Wow.
So, yeah. Yeah, they're big dogs.
Yeah, try and find those machines in the average on-premises data center.
That's cool. That is so, really nice.
Yeah. Yeah, those are definitely beefy.
And okay, so then moving on to the next one is this is something new now. This is the Azure Files, a public preview that got released today. Any of you guys want to pick up on this one?
Yeah, I'm
yeah.
Oh, go ahead, Cal.
I want to talk about this one, too, because I didn't understand the whole thing to begin with. And so go ahead, Evan, but I just had a couple comments about what I thought it was and what it actually is.
I will completely defer to you because my comment was going to be, you know, I live and breathe this space, and as occasionally happens, these things come out, and I go, wow, that's cool. Uh-oh, I've never heard of it. Yes. I just don't figure it out. So
yeah,
if you know something about it, you know more than I do, I'd love to hear it.
No, so when I first heard about it, and I didn't know about it either. I just heard a few days ago about it, but and it's in preview, to be clear. This isn't general available. You have to sign up for a preview. But essentially what this is, when I first heard about it, I was like, oh yeah, so you can set up these SMB shares in Azure and expose them. So that's what I had first heard, and I was like, that's kind of weird. We're going to have, you know, a file share exposed over the internet, or how does this work?
Yeah.
And then when I read a little bit more about it, it was, no, the SMB, the share, the, you know, we're used to with the Windows shares and those types of things, it's only inside Azure, right? So it's essentially between your VMs up there in Azure. And, I didn't realize that at first. I was like, oh, so is this for like DFS, like for people to like attach this thing over the internet, or how does this work? You know, so that was my confusion, but they kind of cleared it up when they started talking about the details.
Yeah. Wait,
so where do you actually host the files? I mean, do you have to set up a special SMB server, Samba server?
No. So basically you sign up for the service, and then there's a special area in the portal for you to go set these shares up. And what I know about it, again, I've just heard about it, and I'm just reading more, but it's just the big use case that people were saying was if you have VMs, maybe they want to share a config or something of that nature. Before, what we had to do, you know, we had blob store and table store and SQL and all these ways, but all of them had a particular API that you had to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of makes it a little easier, I think, when it's something that we're used to as like a file share.
Yeah, the scenario that I heard from one of my colleagues who does HPC work is that she actually sees some real capabilities for this in HPC because I guess in the on-premises world, you know, you have your core central data, right, that everybody's going to chunk up in one place. And so what she was saying is she sees the real possibilities here. We're now in Azure HPC. Instead of having to point to blob storage and then they need to worry about, they can have this share that everybody can read and write to together. So just kind of a variant on that. I'm not entirely sure what it brings capabilities-wise on top of that, but I'm sure we'll see some more stuff over the next couple of months.
I see. Okay, excellent. Well, so that's still in preview. So if folks are interested in something like that, please walk up to the portal and sign up for it. All right, moving on to the next one. Azure Import-Export General Availability. Now, if I remember, this was a way to import and export your VHDs, is that?
I think it's actually any data, right? So you basically ship us a disk.
Okay.
Or a hard drive, excuse me. And then we will, I guess, copy. Or I don't think we mount it per se, but we basically, through our back connections, right, we can get it into your blob storage very fast.
Oh, this is the one where you send them a FedEx package off your hard drive and then you guys import it. Okay.
Yeah, and it's all BitLockered and everything else so that we don't really have access to your data. We're just kind of – it's like SneakerNet, but it's through the mail, right?
Got it.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a requirement, right, Evan? It has to be BitLocker. Like, if you send them a drive, there's like certain requirements it has to be for them to even use it.
Yeah, I know that's in the requirements for the system, because that's part of when you set up the submittal, like you actually provide that key and stuff. I guess so that we can un-BitLocker it so that you can get your stuff off. I don't know what we would do if we got one that wasn't BitLockered. I'm just not gonna go there.
The other thing,
all my super important company information through the mail.
The other thing I didn't realize when this got announced was that the export side of it. I didn't know that I even heard about that before, and I had to look that up. I was like, wait, does that mean they'll actually like pull data out of storage?
Oh, wait a minute,
put it on a hard drive.
I didn't get that.
They will. They will. I looked it up. So they actually will. You can send them a disk that's BitLockered, and they'll mount it. And you have to include instructions in that request that you're talking about, Evan, that says you want to do this and that or whatever. And they'll actually move it onto there and send it back to you. Like, you can actually pull data out, too, that way.
Oh, that's cool. Okay. Makes sense, but...
Yeah, I mean, if you've got like terabytes of data and you need to get it off it for some reason, I suppose, and just taking a backup of it for your own sanity is probably one good reason why, you know.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, because, you know, what, nobody ever wants to leave Azure.
Yeah, of course not. No. All right, that's good. Let's move on to the next one then. This one's kind of interesting. Microsoft anti-malware and security partnerships with Trend Micro and Symantec. It's a public preview, and apparently it's going to provide, I guess some form of endpoint protection and maybe even antivirus protection in the cloud. When I first read this, I was like, I thought, like, you know, the cloud's already, at least our endpoints are already secured by Azure, and, you know, this is not a general purpose file system that we need antivirus software. What's the deal with this, guys?
From my perspective, I see it as a good thing, because I've heard this question many times about, is it supported if I have a IaaS, if I have a VM in Azure, can I put antivirus on it? Like, will you support that? And Evan, maybe you can comment what it was like before this. You know, whenever someone come and said, "Could I put Symantec endpoint protection on here?" Did you guys get that question?
Yeah, we did. We actually got it a lot. You know, what it really comes down to is our answer is sure. If Symantec and Trend will let you do it and support you, we don't really care, right? We'd love, you know, that's kind of a third party thing on top now. The next question is, do they support it? And I think that, to me, is really what this announcement is about, is that those vendors have said, listen, this is, you know, it's obviously, from a security perspective, you want to have these things on your servers, right? We have it on our servers here inside the corporate network. Why wouldn't you have it in your Azure network? But now Trend Micro and Symantec are basically saying, hey, we validated our stuff. It works great on Azure. Azure is a good place to be. And I think the thing that's really cool is you just hit the checkbox, right, saying you want it, and then we do all the configuration for you.
But like I said, I don't understand that. First of all, why wouldn't it run, right? I mean, what makes Azure so special that it can't run antivirus software on it?
I don't think it is. I mean, I think it comes down to, if you go back to the days when virtualization was new, right, lots of things worked just fine in a virtualized environment. But until, you know, companies got through their release cycles and they tested it and they just felt good about it, they weren't really comfortable saying that it was okay.
Okay.
You know, so it's more of a feel good thing than I think a true technical hurdle.
Yeah, and not that there would be anything special there, but one thing that comes to mind for me is those products have really deep low level access to the file system. A lot of them do. So that's something, especially when you're virtualizing things and maybe the file system driver is slightly different and those types of things. I think that's where that added certification helps to, you know, put people's mind at ease.
Got it.
And the other thing I think is, if you're exposing anything off of those machines to the internet, perhaps, maybe if there's some sort of upload mechanism, it's good to have antivirus on there.
Absolutely.
In case somebody would put something malicious up there. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I could see a use case for that, more for applications to scan incoming files. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same things you have on premises, right? It's just kind of extending that stuff to the cloud at that point. So.
True. All right, that was good. The next one's internal load balancing, and so the public preview again. And I believe so. This says that I know we've always had the ability to load balance the public IP addresses, but now we can load balance the internal IPs as well. Is that what it is?
Yeah, I mean, this is the basic, because we had the SLB for external traffic, right? But if you had, you know, let's say you wanted to balance traffic from a VM in your VNet to two other VMs in your VNet,
mm-hmm.
right? You couldn't do that without going back out through the SLB.
And now you can.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. That's a nice feature.
I mean, is this something that's actually bigger than what it looks like? Because to me, wasn't it a big deal before if somebody said, hey, in order for me to hit this other web service, I need to, even if they're both in Azure, I have to go out and come in through the public interface.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is going to, I mean, of all the things that we kind of see in here, I think this is one of those ones that just, it doesn't sound big, but because we haven't had the capability, and you're right, you don't really want to have to go back out through the SLB to do load balancing.
Yeah, I mean, you're just trying to get the load balancing feature and you have to go out and come back in.
Yeah.
And exactly. Now you don't have to do that.
Yeah, you don't leave the data center, but there is a little bit of a hit, right? Because you do get back. It's like hitting a web service on the same machine as IIS.
Right.
Right. You don't want to go like off the machine and go back on. You just want to go partway down the stack and go, oh, this is the same machine and stay there. Same thing.
Yep. Cool. All right, then moving on to some virtual networking features. So they've announced the general availability of the multiple site-to-site VPN and VNet-to-VNet connectivity. And so this was always in preview before, and I believe this
those didn't exist before.
Yeah, this is totally
this is new. Brand new. Okay.
Yeah, these went straight from didn't exist to GA.
Okay, so, and then this is just to, if I remember right, this overcomes the limitation where you could only have a single site to be connectivity to Azure. Is that
correct? Yeah.
Okay.
And then you also couldn't, if I had my VNet over here, I couldn't talk to VMs in another VNet.
Got it.
Right. So now you could do that. And actually, what's interesting is you can actually go across subscriptions.
Mm.
So imagine I want to do a VNet with my customer.
I see.
Right. That's a possibility. And you can also do cross data centers now as well.
Excellent. That is really cool.
Yeah,
Have you been messing with this at all, Evan?
I was just gonna say. So I've been playing with it a little bit, you know, as we try and get ready for it. But we've probably had, and I'm not kidding you, 5 to 6 cases on these two pieces of functionality. Not that anything's necessarily broken, but customers saying, hey, this is brand new and I want to know something about it. Or, you know, hey, I can't quite figure out how to run the PowerShell. I mean, those kind of things. I mean, there was a ton of demand for this to have that many cases in just a couple of days.
That's cool.
Right. Yeah, I just wondered about the configuration of it specifically because I saw some noise about this, some talk about it, saying it looked like a lot of it was done through PowerShell, but I was wondering if you can also configure it through the GUI.
No, not yet. So the portal GUI typically lags behind a little bit, right, because mm-hmm. we have to release the feature and then release the updates to the GUI because mm-hmm. You clearly don't want to go the other way, right?
Yep.
But, yeah, PowerShell, it's a bunch of these things now are PowerShell only. I assume the next couple of portal updates that we'll start to see those pop up.
Yep. Okay. Right then, moving along to the next new feature. This is IP reservation for VIPs and instance-level public IPs for virtual machines. So I think this is something that we've all been waiting for, right, in a way to be able to reserve an IP address.
Yeah. Yep.
I know we've talked about in the past how we had to do all these shenanigans to essentially do the same thing, and now we can just stay in the portal.
Yep.
Now, Evan, some details about this. So the difference between this and what we had before is if I do reserve a public IP and I kill everything for a cloud service, all the VMs in a cloud service, I'm still good, right?
Now, yeah. That's the big difference, right? Before you had to, like Sajid was saying, there was this trick of, hey, I'll put an extra small VM, you know, out there just to kind of maintain it. Now, the only quirk that I have seen to this so far is that you can't reserve one you have already.
Mm, I see.
Right. So I'm not exactly sure what drove us to that limitation. There's got to be something we're fighting, you know, underneath the code because that seems like something a lot of people want. But I wouldn't surprise me if we come out with an update sometime in the future saying you can keep the one you've already got. But today you have to reserve it up front and then deploy your stuff to it. So it'll kind of help you on your next deployment, even if it doesn't help you on today's deployments.
And I believe there was one additional thing. I believe there's like a few bucks extra cost for reserving your IP.
I think you get a few. I believe you get a couple free.
Okay.
Or no, maybe it's not for.
I thought there was like it's a very small, very small number, but it's a couple of bucks extra for reserving it.
Yeah.
And I guess that's fair. Great.
Do you like your DNS entry or not? I mean, that's
really what it is.
Along with this, is there anything about the private IP? Because I'd seen some stuff about that before. So we can do that through PowerShell and over. Yeah. So whenever we want to reserve an internal IP, not the public IP, before we couldn't do that, right? But now there's a way to do it with PowerShell. Am I correct, or is that wrong?
No. Yeah. I'm probably. Maybe
when did that come? Because it was
a month or so ago. I think is when we got DIP reservation.
Yep.
Something like that. So yeah, this is kind of the next natural extension of that. Right now, you can do internal and external.
Yep.
Okay. Great. So let's move on to the next topic, which is the Azure Site Recovery. I think this was previously known as Hyper-V Recovery Manager, and they've got some new features added to them, I believe. Let's just give everybody a little high level on what this allows us to do. This is for essentially taking your VHDs and restoring them and backing them up. Is that what it is?
It's what I understand of it. I haven't used it myself. I played around with it. It was more of a way to basically orchestrate the failover, right, between, maybe you're on-premise in Azure, vice versa, that kind of thing. Like, it was the piece that actually would control that. That's the way I understood it.
I see. Okay.
It's more for like the hybrid, where you had the on-premises and also the stuff in Azure and controlling when that thing fails over.
Okay. Excellent. All right. And moving on to the next one, which is the Azure Remote App, which I believe when I saw this, it was pretty amazed that they were actually letting us do this. So this allows us to, what did we had something called SoftGrid. Is that a product that we used to have or still have?
I remember the name, but I don't remember the feature.
So this seems to be something very similar in the cloud, right, where you can run applications in the cloud, and then you can, from your desktop on-premises, you can access those applications?
Yeah, actually, if you've ever used remote desktop services and app publishing, right, this is exactly that. So you can, and there's actually a demo. We ought to put the link in the show links, but there's a page you can go to that so you can run a demo to kind of see what this looks like and how it works. We have kind of like a test subscription and test client set up, but it basically pulls down this local client. There's a client for iOS. There's one for Android. There's one for, Safari. I mean, there's all these different versions of this, and you, in essence, have this kind of mini RDP session where it just has your app in it, and you can run your app from anywhere.
Wow. Nice.
This kind of works like VDI, right?
I got to be careful because my RDS colleagues, right, the guys that know way more about it, they've forgotten more about RDS than I know. If I say VDI in the context of this, they yell at me and say, no, true VDI is desktop. If you go out and talk to people out in the field in the industry, when they say VDI, this is definitely in scope for what they're talking about. It's publishing the app itself. The neat thing about this is, again, one of the this is something that's going to hit my team, and so I've been kind of paying attention. I'm not the lead on this particular piece, but the what we've really done is under the covers, right? This is kind of the RDS infrastructure, but we've abstracted all the complexity of setting up hosts and session hosts and setting up a gateway and load balancing. We just turn all that into a service. So you set up your images and then you deploy it, and then everything else just, if you scale up, scale down, it's all done, with Azure overlays instead of you having to go in and buy more machines and scale this out and set up your IaaS VMs. It's really, really cool.
Yeah, I've also heard the term thrown around desktop as a service. Is this starting to realize that kind of?
Yeah, I think it's going in that direction, right? I mean, desktop as a service is when you really have the full desktop, right? The desktop experience is actual feature in Windows, like when you're on a server SKU. It would be a really interesting conversation one day to get some of the RDS guys on here, because that's a contentious thing. A lot of people want it, but at the same time, there's a pretty heavy overhead associated with having a full desktop experience, and not everybody wants to pay for the underlying infrastructure it takes to drive that. Right? That's you can only handle X number of those per VM.
Yep.
Right. It's a much, because you have the full, you know, Explorer environment and LSAS and all that stuff versus the remote app. You just have a little tiny piece of that.
Yeah.
Great. Okay, let's move on. I know we're all busy talking about this stuff, but I just realized we're almost half an hour into this.
We just have a great time, and you know, it's a lot of stuff.
This is a lot of stuff. Yeah, we may have to continue this on another episode, but let's see what we can get done here. API management. Now, I believe this was we bought a company, right? For this, what was it called? Appendra?
Affinity?
Maybe Affinity, yeah. You're right. And essentially what this does is it allows you to create a bunch of REST endpoints that you can manage and that you want your developers to access. So you have a bunch of services, cloud services, but you want to control access to those cloud services, you know, REST services essentially. So you could create specific endpoints and have tokens for those endpoints and do the authentication, developer authentication, user authentication, etc. for those endpoints, and manage who uses them and how they're used.
Doesn't this feel like a really neat tie-in with the Internet of Things that we did, the conversation we did a couple weeks ago?
It does, yeah. Because, right, yeah.
It feels like this is kind of one of those pieces that we're putting together to make that scenario happen.
Exactly. And especially if you are front-ending a lot of Internet of Things with a special API, maybe there's an industry standard API that you're coming up with, and you can make that available here. You can charge for it if you want to, and you know, give developers access to it so they can build apps that use it, and then eventually users will actually use those apps, and you'll get additional traffic here. So it's a nice workflow that they have here.
Yep.
That's cool. All right, then the Azure next one is the Azure Cache Service. We've talked about this just recently in an episode, and essentially this is now general availability for the Azure Managed Cache Service, which is the new all-encompassing cache service that we have. It allows applications via a simple API to have a chunk of memory available in Azure that they can use to store all their transient data, and without having to store it to disk and things like that. So
I'm sorry, Suji. I was just going to say, when you guys talked about the Windows Azure Cache, did you guys talk about what a real step change that this is for us, where we're actually using a something somebody else built?
I don't think so.
Yeah, so I mean, like, so if you think about it, like the original cache, like we built it ourselves. It was our own implementation, and you know, there were some challenges with it with this. I guess it's Redis or Redis. I'm not entirely sure how you pronounce it, but this Redis cache, we took an open source implementation and have layered our service stuff on top of it. Like we put our special sauce in it to really extend it. But the end result is we're not writing this from scratch. We're allowing you to do it at scale and manage it easier, which is, I mean, typically we don't like to do things that we didn't write from scratch. You know, so I think this is really neat to see us going, hey, there's this really good solution. Let's leverage that instead of.
Absolutely. You know, yes. The Redis cache. Right? Yeah. It's a distributed cache system, which is very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to that point, I mean, it works with a ridiculous amount of languages. So I think that was one of maybe the keys of having this thing work out of the box with everything from C to Ruby and ActionScript and name it. There's a client for it, you know.
And from Linux as well. So, you know, I think that's the key point here. You could mix and match VMs.
Yep.
Excellent. Then moving on to the next thing, which is the Azure Traffic Manager. This is something that is now in general availability, and it supports both Azure endpoints and external endpoints. And what it is, a Traffic Manager, is it's an intelligent DNS system, essentially. It lets you do very intelligent routing of your requests coming in to any web services, cloud services that you may have in Azure. And you can route them based on where they came from, or some sort of application message that's in the header, and do the routing that way. So it's nice that they've enhanced this with to support both Azure endpoints and external endpoints when it comes to routing. And then last couple of topics here. One is BizTalk Hybrid Connections. To be honest with you, I don't know much about this one. Any of you guys know about it?
I just know it caught my attention because I haven't dug into it, but the way we describe it, where I can go from Windows Azure websites to my on-premises SQL Server without having to write code, that's super powerful. I mean, I'm assuming it means you don't even need a site-to-site.
Oh, I can see what you mean. Okay, so earlier we had to use the queues, the service bus, and now we don't have to do that anymore. I see.
Yeah. So, I mean, because think about all those on-premises SQL servers that people want to expose some element of their data or their MySQL or whatever, and now you don't have to, you know, do a DMZ and all that stuff theoretically, right? You could use this to do that.
Got it. Okay, that's great. I'm glad that they keep enhancing the BizTalk service. That's really nice.
You've got a lot of love for BizTalk, right?
Yeah. And then the last one that we're going to talk about today, it's the last one on the list, actually, is something nice. So if you're an MSDN subscriber and you're using your Azure credit that's available to you, and all MSDN subscribers should activate their Azure credit, you now have access to a whole bunch of client VMs in the repository of VMs that are available, both for Windows 7 and Windows 8.1. And I thought this was pretty nice, right? You could spin up a Windows box, a Windows 7 box, a Windows 8.1 box if you need one now.
Yeah, more in like the test dev space. I mean, that'd be nice. I know we talked about that before, but running your VM up there with 8.1 supported, it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And I was trying to think why they limit this to just MSDN subscribers. Is it a licensing thing? That's probably what it is, right?
I mean, it's probably part of that. If I had to guess, it's part of it is probably we don't, you know, we're talking about that desktop as a service, right? We want to push that this is a dev test scenario and not a, hey, go spin up a bunch of clients.
Yeah, on your company office.
Right, because again, there's, like you said, there's some licensing challenges, and we want to kind of nudge people in the direction of staying compliant, right? You'd hate to say, hey, I'm looking at your subscription, and you have 5,000 Windows VMs, so that's all licensed.
Yeah.
Yeah, how many people are actually using them?
Yeah, exactly.
And, guys, I'd put a something in the link dump. It's actually the only link I'd put in there this week, and the only reason I bring it up is because it ties in kind of with this. And that's the VM Depot. I wasn't even aware of this. I'd heard about it and I went and checked it out. It's kind of cool. So what it is basically we have this division called the Microsoft Open Technologies. And what happens is we set up this thing called the VM Depot, which is a community-driven area for people to, you know, build operating systems, configure them for certain things, configure applications or dev stacks or whatnot on these VMs, and then upload them in there and share them with the community. Now, this isn't something where Microsoft's in there, you know, certifying these things and checking them for compatibility and performance and all those types of things. It's more of a open source type thing where people are, you know, it's a community sharing initiative. But it's really cool. If you go up there, there's a huge list of pre-configured things up there, anything from Linux the whole way to, you know, Windows stuff that people have set up. So kind of cool, the links and the links.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. I was just kind of browsing through it. I knew it was there, but I'd never actually looked through. That's pretty neat.
That's a really nice link. Thanks a lot, Cale. All right, you know, this has really gone on to be quite a long episode, so we'll just we'll wrap it up over here. We were going to discuss some real-world scenarios, but I think we'll pick it up next week in the interest of time. I want to thank Cale and Evan, who did most of the talking today, and I'm glad they did because they know a whole lot about this, and much more about this than I do. So thanks, guys, for all your insights into this. And
anytime.
We'll thanks, guys.
See you guys next week. Take care.
See y'all.
See you.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle, @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.